With the sound of the bombers, both men react as they did the first time with fear, but this time instead of disguising it, as you said, they admit to it. And that admittance is, I think, the bond between them. And Freud also, I think, shaken by the whole experience, for the first time at the very end of the play, repeatedly through the play, as you mentioned, there are reports on the BBC about the war. And the BBC at that point had a live orchestra. And when the news was finished, the orchestra would jump in and play music until the next news bulletin. And every time that the news was over, Freud immediately turned it off so he didn't have to listen to the music. Lewis catches on to that at some point. And as you said, he equates it with Freud's wall that he puts up to shield his emotions because he feels they're being manipulated. But at the very end of the play, after Lewis leaves, Freud listens to the radio. And for the first time, he doesn't turn off the music. And the last image of the play is him just looking at the radio as if trying to really understand music and his own aversion to it.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking not only to their offices, but also off the couch in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is playwright Marc St. Germain. Marc has written over 18 plays, and we're going to focus today on a particular play called Freud's Last Session. It is a fictional encounter between Freud and C.S. Lewis. It's set 3 weeks before Freud's death and immediately at the beginning of World War II. It's a rather dramatic setting. And through the intense dialogue that he creates between these two individuals, we note, number one, for me, the similarity between this intense encounter and the clinical encounter. In both settings, it's two people in a room engaging intensely with each other, with layers of meaning yet to be revealed about the nature of that meeting. And it takes place in the office in a certain framework, and he has his own framework as a playwright to help create that. And we talk about that, and it's quite fascinating. And we have an excerpt from two actors who read just some brief parts towards the end that really add power and show the skill of the playwright, first of all, but also shows what he created, a very intense moment between these two people that changes both of them in some ways. Marc, as I say, is a prolific playwright. He's written 18 plays, and he produces most of his work at the beginning in the Berkshires at the Barrington Stage Company. And he has a new play coming out called The Happiest Man on Earth, which will be released this May and will be running in the Berkshires this summer. And significantly, this play, Freud's Last Session, has been, he wrote the screenplay for it and has been, is being turned into a movie starring Anthony Hopkins as Freud. This was a big media event not long ago when it was announced. And I thought it would be a special privilege to get a chance to speak to the writer of what will become a widely discussed theatrical production. I will leave it at that. Mark really did his research. He really studied the life of Freud and Anna, and he really, for me, captures the spirit of the man very beautifully. So here is my conversation with Mark St. Germain. Mark, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad you're with us.
Thank you, Harry.
You've written a play that consists of two men in a room together, speaking and engaging with each other, at times with intensity and passion. And for those of us who are clinicians, we're familiar with that. But I'm going to suggest that the structure of your play has an additional similarity with the clinical encounter. And let me explain what I mean. It is not unusual for an individual to walk into our offices, and while standing, before they lie down on the couch, they'll chat about something happening in the external world. And they will chat about it in a way that suggests, well, this isn't really the session, this is just our chatting. And then they lie down, and they say what they say, and we say what we say. And then they'll get up, and in what's famously called a doorknob conversation, they may continue the chat, again, often about external matters, again, as if this too is not really part of the session. And the attentive analyst, and in this case, the experienced playwright, knows that these bookends are not only very much part of the experience, but often contain the most meaningful part of the experience, that they capture what we call the latent meaning of the encounter. But far from being just throwaway lines, since it is understood to be unimportant, it is therefore more important because it is more revealing. And that's exactly how I encountered your play. The curtain goes up, and while these two men are in the room, the first words uttered are from the radio, the ever-present radio, and the BBC announcer. And he announces that Germany has invaded Poland, and this is the beginning of the war. The last words of the play are also from this BBC announcer, announcing King George coming on the radio and announcing the beginning of the war from England's side. And these bookends, to me, are what the play is about. The fear that these two men have, for their own different reasons, based on their own life stories, and they're coming together. You have Freud reaching out in this fictional encounter, reaching out and asking to see C.S. Lewis. And we learn a great deal about each of the characters along the way. Freud, another theme, is living with his jaw cancer. He is, as you say in the play, having gone through 30 operations in what is an agonizing and terminal illness. So he is very much aware of his death, which will take place 3 weeks after the setting of the play. And there's this prosthesis in his mouth, this jaw prosthesis, nicknamed by his daughter Anna as the monster. And you make very clear in the play that Freud announces that no one touches his prosthesis. Martha, his wife, does not touch his prosthesis. His doctors do not touch his prosthesis. Only Anna touches his prosthesis. And this rich, rich moment you treasure and you save till the end of the play because it forms a moment of great intensity and great intimacy between he and Lewis. We'll get to all that, But let's pull back and let me ask you to describe the action of the play. I suspect most of our listeners are not familiar with it. And also tell us who C.S. Lewis was. I imagine our listeners in the UK will be very familiar with him. I knew him somewhat, but learned more through reading your work. And I learned that after Churchill, he was the second most familiar radio voice during World War II, which is saying a great deal. But tell us about you and the play and these two men.
Sure. The play came about because I went to see a lecture, and there was in the lobby a bunch of books on sale. And I saw one book by Dr. Armin Nicolai, The Question of God. And on the cover, there was a picture of Freud, there was a picture of C.S. Lewis. And my first thought was how opposite these men were in so many things and so many beliefs. And my second thought was, that's what drama is a conflict of ideas. Both people want something or believe something different than the other. So I thought it would be really interesting to put the two men in a room together. The next thought was, what would be the most dramatic time to do it? And that would be, to my mind, the start of the war, World War II, and also right before Freud's death. Now, C.S. Lewis is well known for his books that he wrote later in life, Chronicles of Narnia, Screwtape Letters, Christian writer who really wrote a number of remarkable books. At this point, he had just started out as a writer. And what Freud was interested in, he had learned of him through an essay that he wrote. But he had learned also through a colleague that C.S. Lewis was an atheist, as he was. And Freud, interestingly, wrote many books in his life denying the idea of a God and the use of religion. So when he found out that a person of his mindset had this sudden conversion experience, he wanted to know what happened. And in his mind, I imagined, he was thinking, I've spent my whole life opposing this. What did I miss? Did I miss anything? Death is coming. And is there something I haven't been able to understand? So he summons Lewis to his house. Lewis, Freud is a famous figure, Lewis is not. And the two men engage in a conversation, wide-ranging conversation, but about life. And that's the basis of the play.
What struck me is, and I'm interested in the kind of research you did on each of the men, but I'm fairly versed in the many Freud biographies, and to my knowledge and sense of the man, you really captured his spirit beautifully, his humor, his brilliance, his self-importance, his enjoyment of intellectual jousting. That really comes across in the play and how the actors represent it. What kind of research did you do?
An awful lot of biographies. Dr. Nicolai set up, in his book, he would do a chapter on how they were different in their beliefs on a certain subject. And I had thought at the beginning that would be all I needed to write the play, and I was far from right. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was months and months of reading and then making enough notes and getting the feel that I knew enough about them, and then trying to see if I could write in their voices, in what I imagine their voices. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And eventually I got to the point that the writing didn't take terribly long. The research took much longer than the writing.
Yeah, you presented a challenge for yourself because you have Freud saying more than once, quote, what people tell me is less important than what they cannot. Now, that's quite a challenge for a man who's using language to express himself. How did you, that's my thought, how the structure spoke. that you didn't just rely on the words, because by definition, they're limited. Can you fill us in? I shared with you my thinking about what you're framing it as you did meant and was designed to accomplish. What was going through your mind?
Well, I mentioned at the beginning, really, the dramatic process, and both people were there for a certain reason. I mean, Lewis, because he was summoned at the beginning, and he was intimidated, and he didn't know why he was being called. He had written a book that parodied Sigmund Freud with a character that was bombastic and self-important, and he thought he was being called on the carpet. But he wasn't. He was there for this other reason. I mean, Freud had something he wanted out of Lewis. And I think he would have loved if he could have dismissed Lewis in 15 minutes and sent him home, that he was not intellectually able to have a conversation with Sigmund Freud. But Lewis turned out to be very well-spoken and held his beliefs deeply and was willing to go once he was provoked into a conversational battle. He was able to hold his own with Freud.
You know, it's so interesting listening to you, because when I find myself speaking about the characters in the play, I do what you did, but Freud said this and Lewis said this. And of course, neither of them said any of those things. It's you have Lewis saying this and you have Freud saying this, because in fact, this never took place. This is fictional.
Right.
But as a playwright, I guess they live for you as real characters, even of your making. It's like an actor being in character. They are them at that moment.
Yeah, very much so. And you've heard, I'm sure, the stories about people saying, well, this wrote itself. And in a way, it is true that you might say, I want to go and in a very loose outline, these are topics I'd like to discuss, and these are dramatic events I think that can happen. But you get to the point where you're not writing so much as listening to them and writing down what they say in your mind.
Well, that is both the creative process, and I suspect, borrowing your instrument, I'll say that Lewis would say that's like the divine is speaking through one. Mm-hmm. We are a receiver of the divine, not the definer or creator of it.
Right. Exactly.
You also have Freud say to him that debate is not why we are here. Now, again, the manifest story and the one that the reviews of the play all talk about, they say this is a play about atheism or not. And it doesn't seem to me that that's at all what it's about. And you have Freud say debate is not why they are here. What's your sense of why you have Freud calling Lewis?
I think desperation. I'm suspicious if someone says that they don't like apples, and then they mention 10 times afterwards they don't like apples. Well, Freud denied the existence of God, and he derided people who believed in God, but he didn't do it once. He did it repeatedly and wrote about it repeatedly. So I'm taking that to be he's not satisfied with his conclusion fully, that he can put it to rest in his own mind. And I think that's the impulse that drives the play. Because at the beginning, Lewis doesn't need anything. He doesn't need to confront Freud on anything. But once put in the defensive procedure, he's arguing for his life beliefs.
At the end of his life. And you have it at the end of his life for a reason. It's 3 weeks before he's to die, and he dies by his own hand. The arrangement he had from the very beginning with his physician, Max Scher, who was also an analyst, was that when the pain became relentless and there was no help of any kind of, or no possibility of any kind of healing or cure, that he asked Max Scher to promise to give him enough medication that he could put an end to his life. And that's what happened. What made you set it at that point?
Well, it was just the most dramatic point to set the story. I mean, most people would wince at the idea of a 90-minute play of two people in a room talking to each other.
Right.
And so it needed to have other hooks to bring you in. And the war was certainly, you couldn't get more dramatic than that on the day it went into the war. His pain, Freud's pain, and his demands for his doctor to arrive with something to alleviate it is driving him, his anger. And it just seemed the most effective way to keep the play going. Phone calls, the radio, all these things push the action forward.
But you also include a great deal of content in it. You really cover Freud's life very meaningfully. Certainly Anna has a presence in the play. For example, part of the discussion is how he was Anna's analyst, and that the paper she wrote to become an analyst was a paper about sadomasochistic erotic fantasies, which Freud reveals in the play were her own, learned in her analysis. That's the kind of thing that we analysts know about. It's sort of an inside baseball thing. But how did you come about it and decided to bring it forward, other than its dramatic quality?
Well, first of all, I came and found it through just all the research, and then researching Anna and seeing what she had written about. I think it's something that's mentioned in the play early and then comes to a dramatic conclusion, where Freud talks about his prosthesis, and he says that he won't allow anyone to touch it beside Anna. And I did find that unusual. I thought when he didn't allow his wife to help him with it. He didn't allow anyone but Anna. And I thought, well, then not only does he trust Anna in a way, but there's a relationship there that can be explored. And so later, when he's in trouble and choking and needs help, it becomes sort of symbolic that Lewis steps in and rescues him by taking it out of his mouth.
Symbolic of?
An intimacy. And I think the idea that Lewis rescues him is what Freud would have liked him to rescue him philosophically as well. He wished Lewis had come in. Part of him wishes Lewis would just be adult and leave. But there was the 1 in 1,000 chance that Lewis was very intelligent and would say something to him that might give him some reassurance with death 2 weeks away. And Lewis could not give him that. They both recognize that at one point, toward the end of the play. And I think both people are broadened by the other's experiences.
So your vision of the play is that Freud called Lewis to meet with him in the hope that Lewis would help him find some comfort in relation to the divine as he's dying?
I think that, but like I said, that would be an underlying thought. I think on the surface, he would say, just want to prove this man's a fool and that he has nothing to teach me, that I have nothing to learn. And then all of a sudden, he's actively involved in debating this with Lewis, which I don't think he would have expected at all. And so the two men gain an appreciation of each other, and Lewis very quickly loses the awe that he has about Freud and the fear that he's going to be spanked, basically, by Freud for writing about him. So they man to man go at each other with their ideas,
which touches on my somewhat different experience of reading it. It was more what you just said. They go man to man, touching on these ideas, and they do touch with the exchange that we're going to play in a moment. But I experienced, Freud had a famously difficult history of relationships with his male friends. Speaking of trajectories to them, they began very intensely with idealization. There was usually then some disappointment, followed by some alienation that was often equally intense to the idealization. They were filled with struggle. You have him say how much he enjoyed the struggle in Paradise Lost. The quote from the play is, from Freud, "I was comforted by the clash between God and Satan." And that struck me, his comfort with clashing. And I take your play to mean that he was hungry for a clash, and that it wasn't the content so much that he wanted to become a believer at the end of it. He wanted to do what he did in his love language, which is to struggle with another man. The outcome didn't matter. He just needed it. And I thought you picked that up when you had him touch the prosthesis. So since we've referenced that, let me set it up a little bit. I'm going to play a little excerpt from two actors reading the play along with a narrator describing the action. This is at the very end of the play. And the content of the argument debate that precedes it and is getting more and more heated. First, it is about euthanasia. Lewis is aghast and outraged that Freud is planning to take his life. And then it segues into the topic of music. Music, quite famously, was something that Freud did not warm to. It's something you make a point of in the play. And Lewis speaks of his understanding that Freud has trouble giving himself over to certain feelings. This has been actually well written about in our field, and the whole subject of what we call pre-Oedipal life that Freud did not get to, people link with his discomfort with music, but that's for another time. So that's the moment they're at, and I'm going to play this excerpt, and then I'm going to ask you to tell us about what it was like to write it.
"I also think you're terribly selfish. Putting your own pain above the pain of those you love. You lie to yourself, thinking you can control death like you control your world and your daughter. You think you can outthink your fear by hiding behind your desk of dead gods. But the truth is that you're terrified.
You know nothing.
I know that when the siren sounded, you didn't behave like a man who took comfort. This was his last day. You ran for your gas mask.
As did you. What did you believe in at that moment, God or death? Your faith vanished as quickly as your precious joy, because underneath all your self-protective lies, you know he does not exist.
Where is your joy? Have you ever felt it? Have you found it through anyone, anything in your entire life?
I found the truth that you cannot face, that the end is the end. You busy your doubts. You bury your doubts as deeply as you do your memories of the war, because at your core, you are nothing more than a coward."
Freud pulls the handkerchief out of his pocket, puts it to his face, and it is soaked through with blood. Lewis jumps to his feet.
"Sit down. Here, I'll call an ambulance."
No hospital. Towels, a lavatory."
Freud gestures towards the entrance to the room, and Lewis runs out. Freud reaches into his mouth, trying to pull out his prosthesis, but the pain is too much. Freud stops, gasping. He tries again, his back now to the audience, but begins to choke. Lewis runs in with towels. Freud's choking grows more violent.
Harry!
He gestures towards his mouth, and Freud opens the mouth while Lewis reaches in. Freud shouts out with pain, and Lewis draws back. Freud grabs his hand, pulls him closer.
Take it out!
Lewis reaches back into Freud's mouth, trying to grasp the prosthesis, struggling with it as Freud gasps for breath. Lewis pulls again and again, and finally wrenching the prosthesis out. Lewis hands him a towel.
Water.
Lewis goes to the desk, pours a glass of water, and brings it to Freud. Freud rinses out the prosthesis and reinserts it.
Would you like to lie down?
The monster nearly won.
Do you have anything for the pain?
The desk. Pills. The top drawer.
Lewis goes to the desk and finds a pill bottle, looking at it.
Aspirin? Nothing stronger.
Freud takes the aspirin from Lewis, and Lewis gives him the glass that still has water in it.
I have to think clearly. Please, go.
course not. I'll stay with you until someone comes. No.
And it is after that intense exchange that you then have the sound of what sounds like bombers overhead. And only at that point do you have Lewis saying, "I admit I was frightened." To which Freud responds, "Yes, so was I." And that is a clinical moment where when people share an intense connection, then the vulnerability can become available to each of them. In this case, they can own their fear. And walk us through that powerful piece of writing you came up with.
Well, I think you have the crisis, and there's really no end. Both men really don't express themselves about Freud having been rescued by Lewis. And there needs to be, in my mind, there needed to be a connection between them there. And I didn't want anything sentimental with Freud, thanking him for saving his life. Mm-hmm. So with the sound of the bombers, both men react as they did the first time with fear, but this time instead of disguising it, as you said, they admit to it. And that admittance is, I think, the bond between them. And Freud also, I think, shaken by the whole experience for the first time at the very end of the play, repeatedly through the play, as you mentioned, there are reports on the BBC about the war. And the BBC at that point had a live orchestra. And when the news was finished, the orchestra would jump in and play music until the next news bulletin. And every time that the news was over, Freud immediately turned it off so he didn't have to listen to the music. Lewis catches on to that at some point. And as you said, he equates it with Freud's wall that he puts up to shield his emotions, because he feels they're being manipulated. But at the very end of the play, after Lewis leaves, Freud listens to the radio, and for the first time, he doesn't turn off the music. And the last image of the play is him just looking at the radio as if trying to really understand music and his own aversion to it. And I think that's the completion of that whole conflict.
The deepening of their moment together opened up something in him that allowed him to reconsider, to reflect upon, to become available to new parts of himself. That's quite special. It is also special that you wrote this play into a screenplay, and the role of Freud is going to be acted, or is actually, as we speak, being acted by Anthony Hopkins. Tell us what it's like to write a play and then turn it into a screenplay.
Well, I've always written plays, and at a certain point, I had been doing television. And really, I didn't want to be part of a television atmosphere. I enjoyed being with other writers, but I didn't want to be spending my whole time coming up with ideas. And it just felt mechanical to me at the time. So the alternative was trying to write screenplays. And I was very fortunate to sell a number of them. And so after Freud did well here in our country, and then in many countries, I thought there's a way to expand it into a movie by including Anna Freud in it, by dramatizing some of the things they talk about, Lewis's experiences in the war, Freud's memory of his father, Lewis's relationship with Mrs. Moore, who lived with him. Mrs. Moore was the mother of a friend of his, Patty, who died in the war. And all of these things could be explored with a screenplay. And I enjoyed doing it. I enjoyed writing it.
Does it take a different skill set?
It's a different mindset, it is.
Yeah.
As you think, you definitely think more visually than you do with a play. You do have to put yourself, it's a whole different set of muscles. But I had the play to begin with, so I knew the gist of it. Now I just had to make it filmable.
And how does it work? You write the screenplay and see if someone will pick it up, or if someone shares your interests and has a commitment to you?
It used to work that I would, I had a film agent for when I was writing screenplays, but then I stopped for several years. So I did not have an agent anymore. This came about really, through my daughter and a friend of hers father was a producer. We had him over for dinner and he had asked if I still had any screenplays. And so I gave him, Alan Greisman is his name. And I gave him this and he was intrigued and he gave it to the director, Matthew Brown. And I'd say it was 7 years after that until now when the movie's being filmed. It just takes forever. And the studios were only interested if there was someone they could consider a name playing Freud or Lewis. It really had the same resistance that the play did. It was very difficult, even though it was successful at Barrington Stage Company in the Berkshires when we did it the first time. Excuse me. It's extended many times. They brought it back the next year. Any time that a producer in New York was approached, they said, why would I want to do a play about God? And why, people can go buy tickets to a musical. Why would they want to see this play? Uh-huh. So it was really hard. And it was the work of the producer, Carolyn Rossi Copeland, who pushed and pushed and finally got a production, got producers behind her. And it ran for several years. It did very well. And so because of that, then it spread, was published and spread.
And it's being played, you say, around the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's been interesting to see some of the productions. I mean, you talk about the scene with the prosthesis. I remember when we did it the first time, we were very careful not to make it too violent, not to show that much blood. I think the only blood we actually showed was when Lewis dipped the handkerchief in water and you saw the water turn pale red. Well, I went to see a production in Buenos Aires that was really confrontational. And they played that whole scene in full view of the audience to the point of Lewis putting his foot up on the chair and yanking this thing. And it was so violent, a lady passed out in the audience.
Oh my, and, right. The tenderness was all hidden.
There was no tenderness. I mean, it was just battle. And so it's been interesting to see different countries, different productions, and what they do.
Are you involved with the filming at all?
I've been really involved with the director since this began years ago. And we're still in communication. It actually, they're in pre-production now. They start filming on March 5th, and they'll be filming in Dublin. They're doing a couple weeks of a closed set because they're very careful about COVID over there.
I see.
And when they film some outdoor scenes, I'll go over and visit.
And when do we expect to be able to see it, either on our small screen or on the big screen?
I have no idea.
You don't know how it goes?
Right. Oh, it will take them, I'm sure, another half year after to edit it. And then it will depend on what they do with it. I know Sony is involved with distribution. I don't know what will what the date will be. I can't imagine.
I'm sure you're aware that the headlines, because it did make headlines, and they were Anthony Hopkins plays Freud. I mean, that's the lead. What has that led to for you? Because, I mean, obviously you're the author of the play and the screenplay. Does your phone just not stop ringing, or do they not attend? What's the consequences when something so momentous in the entertainment world like that happens?
It really, like I said, I don't have an agent for film or television anymore. Mm-hmm. There is a striking ageism in the business. And the idea of an old white guy getting back into it is questionable.
So it's not just ageism; it's also I don't want to use the word racism, but maybe I will. I mean, the way you put the white guy antagonism, is that part of it?
I was told that
you were
face to face, with several people in theater. Theater is certainly concerned with. BIPOC and diversity, and understandably, I understand that. So I've really kept pursuing theater. I don't have something to jump in with I might adapt another play at some point. I have a couple screenplays that were optioned and not filmed. But I'm much more still interested in theater, and I have a new play that will be coming up this spring called The Happiest Man on Earth, which is a story of Eddie Jacku, who survived two concentration camps and then had to find his meaning of life and how he could come back to life again. And so that'll be done starting off at Barrington Stage. And
when will that be produced? When will that be available?
That'll be premiering the end of May at Barrington Stage in the Berkshires.
Uh-huh. And throughout the summer.
Yes, and hopefully, like Freud and some other plays I had, will do well enough, then it would be either going into New York or being done regionally and out there. But it's a very inspirational story, so I hope it goes well.
And you've also written a number of books. The Mirror Man, Walking Evil, tell us about.
Well, Walking Evil is a sort of an autobiography with great liberties about how a dog that came into the household changed, kind of blew up our lives. The dog, its name was Evie, but when we went to a training class, they called her Evil, and that stuck. So, Evil had a love for my wife and an absolute hatred of me, and would do everything possible to make my life miserable. So it's a comedic book. The other book, The Mirror Man, is a thriller, and that's something I would like to adapt at some point.
Yeah, as a film. Have very nice reviews. I look forward to reading them. Yeah, yeah. Mark, thank you for spending this time with us. It's a pleasure to meet you, to study your work. I've seen it put on through these readers that are online. I've read through the play itself numbers of times. I really admired how you did capture the man and the exchanges between the two of them, and how you use the set and the time and the set with the BBC and the announcers. They may be everyday skills to a playwright, but since I'm not one, I really came to appreciate and admire how you told and presented a story that was quite alive about important people and important ideas. Thank you for participating. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.